the TV Podcast. We're here to talk about The Expanse again. This time we're going to talk about a lot of episodes. Episodes 5 through 8 of Season 1 of The Expanse. Back to the Butcher, Rock Bottom, Windmills, Salvage. It's almost a sentence, but it's not. I'm Jason Snell. Joining me to talk about The Expanse are our three fine people who are also in space with me, I guess. Space! Tony Sindelar, hi.
Hello, space nerds. Hello, space cops. Hello, people with hats. I'm here.
I also would like to call in our expert on all the various CGI animals who live in space, Joe Rosensteel. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I'm very excited to talk about them once more. I thought our little furry companions had escaped, but
they had to take a final bow before we left series, I guess. That episode was the series finale. Anyway, Erica Ensign's also here, and she was not responsible for any of those jokes. Hi.
Nope. I washed my hands of this situation entirely.
Good. Good. So I think we should do what we do on this podcast, if I remember correctly, which is talk about the different segments in the different locations as a part of this. But what we should start with is an interesting decision made in episode 5, which is we spend a little time getting to know some facts about Fred Johnson, the leader of the OPA at Tycho Station, by doing a flashback that actually adapts some material from one of the novellas that the authors of the Expanse book series wrote, called The Butcher of Anderson Station, about Fred and his history, which is interleaved with the rest of episode 5 in a flashback sequence reminiscent of Lost or Arrow or a show like that, in which we learn that there are a lot of really nice innocent people and kids and stuff and some misguided minors or something, and Fred Johnson leads an assault on the station, and even though they try to surrender, they kill everybody. Just to get to know our new friend Fred Johnson.
You know, maybe it's because I have watched so much Babylon 5, but whenever I see a cute child on a show like this,
dead,
I always figure, oh, they are going down.
And then you think, I'm going to be on a podcast with Jason to talk about
exactly.
It. No
exactly.
No doubt.
And this is exactly how it happens every time.
Mm-hmm. I'm here. Sorry, space kids. I'm the angel of death for space kids. That's just how it works. I thought it was an interesting decision to basically say, hey, this guy has a complicated history, this guy that you just met, and here's a thing that happened in the past. Interesting decision. Also, it felt a little bit like it's slowing the plot down because they are trying to figure out how to get to the ending that they want for the first 10 episodes. And it's like, sure, let's throw in some backstory. But, you know, I don't know. I think it felt useful in making us not trust Fred Johnson so much.
Mm-hmm.
Joe?
Yeah, because in the book, I would say that I was initially more prone to trusting Fred Johnson right off the bat. Like in the book, it just seemed like he was just, you know, like, yeah, sure, go trust him.
He's like a guy behind a desk who's, yeah, looking out for people. Yeah.
Yeah, but with this, you know, I could appreciate what they were trying to do, where it makes it just a little bit more iffy. You know, because he's killed minors and minors, so it's a little rough.
Oh, yes.
Well played.
So much. Yeah, so this is, and in episode 5, what we've got is, this is the lifeline for our friends who are the survivors of the Cant, is to go to Fred. Fred has sent them a message saying, come to Tycho Station, and I can get you here, I can change your transponder codes so that you are, you know, you don't come up as a Martian Navy ship, come and join me. So their backs are kind of against the wall, and he is providing an outlet. And so it's a nice kind of compliment to that, to see this. Well, it's interesting because he's an Earth military guy who kills a bunch of Belters. And now we see him and he's basically in charge of the OPA. Or at least a part of the OPA. So there's also left out there that big question mark, like, well, how did that happen? How did this guy go from killing Belters as a representative of Earth to being a representative of the Belters? And so that's all mixed into episode 5 too.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else about other thoughts about Fred Johnson in general? The Rosinante is dubbed here. This is the that we finally get a name for the ship, and they reset the. There's that moment where they think, well, this could blow us up. It could be a trap, or we could just change the name of our ship. And they go, bing, yay, the name change. We didn't die, and then they fly off to Tycho Station. But this is so they've got their journey too to get to Tycho, and they of course they arrive in episode 6. thoughts about the journey of the Rosinante now that we've got it. This is I turned to Lauren while we were watching this, and I said, this is what it's all been leading to. They have a name for their little ship now. Yay.
I still don't feel like that's completely organic with the naming.
Holden is very quick to dump mm-hmm. these names without yeah. sort of any explanation, isn't it?
Also, there's a little bit of a heavy-handedness when we get to the scene with the mom we'll talk about later, where it's just like, oh, yeah, Cervantes.
Yes.
Like, okay, mm-hmm. Got it. My boyfriend turned to me on the couch, and he's just like, oh, like Don Quixote, which, you know, and I was like, yes, exactly like that. Mm-hmm. that is exactly what that is.
Yeah, and that episode was even called Windmills. I was like, yes. Wow, guys.
Well, you know, you're going to have the Rosinante and all the references. Episode one has a Don Quixote reference too. So I mean, that's part of the story, I guess. I thought it was cute that there's the Cervantes bit when Avasarala visits his home in Montana, a scene that does not exist in the books, which was I like that kind of filling in the gaps of things that I don't think we've ever seen his home in the books. In Montana, it's only referenced. So she goes there to get more information about Holden. I thought that was kind of interesting. But yes,
well, that's interesting because I think that was my single favorite scene of all of these four episodes that we watched for this. I thought it was just electric watching these two really cool female characters interacting and, you know, not pulling any punches. It was electric and fun for me.
Yeah.
Interesting to know it's not in the book.
Out in the snow. Well, no, because Avasarala doesn't exist in book one. She doesn't appear as a main character, at least until book two. So they're kind of guessing what she would be doing back on Earth during the plot of episode or of book one, and then extrapolating from that. So I thought this was a really interesting thing with the snow. She's out in the snow having her conversations after she leaves about like, well, we're going to kill him. She's like, oh, all right. You know? Well, let's talk about Earth then. And we'll get back to space in a bit. We do have that scene, that's episode 7. What else is Avasarala doing in these four episodes? Does anybody? I mean, she sells out her friend and gets him banned from Mars Forever, and he kills himself.
Yep.
What?
She lines up a spy on Tycho Station. That's one of the things she does, right?
Yep. Which has quite a bit of import. In the later episodes.
Right.
But there was
She does it once again by, you know, just like really, really strong arming someone and basically blackmailing this guy, being like, I can't remember if it was his son or daughter is in prison. Like, nope, they're not getting out if you don't help.
Yeah, that was a cool scene in the aquarium. Again, you know, hey, we got all this water. She does blackmail him, and it was the son who was in trouble for something, and she's like, oh, well, you know, I could help and get him out of that. So it's nice to see her do that manipulation. But I think there was like a whole episode where we didn't see Avasarala at all. I don't remember if it was 5 or 6, but she just seemed to not be there. And then I was happy to see her back in Windmills doing something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked her. I mean, what's great about that character, I think, is that she is... Yes, she's a grandmother and all of that, and she has this kind of this one side, and then she's got this other side where she is just hard as a rock. Like, it doesn't, you know, no emotional compromise in her business. When she's doing business, she is strictly business. And even her lifelong friendship, she leaves that guy hung out to dry because she needs to have the information about Mars. And then, and then although she argues against them taking Holden off the board, you know, she also is like, you know, aware that that stuff happens. I mean, I like that combination with her.
And she's also savvy enough to kind of, you know, she does have these emotions. We keep seeing both sides of her. And she's savvy enough to know when to use the soft part to her advantage, because, you know, and she almost gets kicked out of Holden's homestead, but then she reveals a little bit of her past and how right. she's lost her own son in the Marines, and that is why one of Holden's moms is like, okay, you know, she lets her stay, and then they end up having sort of the heart-to-heart conversation, and then Avisarlo actually gets the information that she needs, and it turns out to be a moot point because they decide to kill him anyway, but just from her perspective, every single move that she makes is it's calculated and it works exactly to her advantage, and she gets what she wants.
You mentioned one of his moms because he's the product of a large group marriage. If I have a disappointment about that scene, is that's an awfully deserted homestead for a group of whatever it is, seven people who live there with their child. So that I was a little disappointed that it, you know, it was, I get the focus of the one-on-one of their conversation is good. And I really think that that's a powerful scene, but I would have liked a scene where she's pulled away to the one-on-one from their kind of home life, which is, you know, bustling and lots of people.
Because especially there's kind of the big idea that, like, he does not have a singular mother, right? That he was raised by this collective.
Right. Well, there's the one who carried him, which is, I think, the one we see, but that it's, he's actually the product of a merged kind of DNA from all of these different people.
And so, I mean, in some ways, the kind of future-y, you know, version of that is a little bit undermined in terms of, like, she's going to go and talk to the mom, the singular mom, when really...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and maybe she, you know, you see a bunch of people, and then the one who steps forward to have the conversation with Avisarla is the one who is the one who's got the fortitude to match up with her. And she's the one who's like, I'll talk. We'll talk. But instead, we just sort of... It's a very empty farmhouse that they're in. And I was just a little disappointed.
It's still Montana. Jason.
It is. There's not a lot.
They have one kid with seven adults, right?
So,
you know, there's not children underfoot everywhere.
That's true. Yeah, I just expected the rest of the...
What do you want?
I just expected the rest of the people to be around and to give us a little glimpse into that family life. But
they're busy maintaining the windmills.
I guess so.
There was only that one. Other father there, and she sort of dispatches him, like, go away, I need to talk to this crazy, I need to talk to this UN representative in here. But it's not entirely clear to my satisfaction what the dynamics of this are. It does seem sort of like they get the land that they're on for their farm because they all agreed to have one kid, but I'm not sure about the dynamics exactly. And I can't remember if it was ever clearly defined in the books. Since they don't really talk much about his home life.
I think what you just summarized lines up with what I'm remembering from the books. And I forget how much of that we get in the show. But the idea is that, like, you know, space is extremely limited on Earth. They get a bunch by basically, I guess, giving up their right to all each individually have children, right? So they are therefore kind of given... an amount of land that one could therefore actually operate a farm on, which, you know, perhaps an individual or a single family would not normally have in the constrained Earth geography.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to mention about that, about Avisarla finding out that her friend has killed himself, is I like that, because what it shows is that even though she's all business, it's not like she doesn't have feelings. It's just that the business part of her will always, she's going to do business. The feeling part of her will regret it later, but it doesn't stop her from doing that. And that's that character. I feel like that's about right, that she's going to do what she thinks is right. And no matter the costs, but it doesn't mean that she won't regret it later and feel bad about it, but she's still going to do it. She's kind of ruthless in that way. And I like that about that character.
I wish we got a little bit more insight into the people that she's kind of working with and working against, because I feel like I'm being a little left out in terms of knowing, like, what are their agendas or you know.
Right, because there's the guy who's like, nope, we're assassinating him. And she's like, I don't think you should do that. And he's like, no, the Secretary General says we're going to do that. It's like, who? I know in the book it's described a little bit more, but yeah, in the TV show I sort of feel like, now who is that guy? What is his job? How does can she override him? Can she not override him? And
Having read the book but not remembering it, I read it as she can't override him because he's, in part, there's a lot, you know, they do some stuff with how they stage that thing, right? They're in a meeting. It's his meeting in the office. He's behind the desk and they're the two people in front of him. And he says no.
Right.
So, but I forget.
Or he says the Secretary General says no. Yeah. So he's like the mouthpiece for the Secretary General, but we never see the Secretary General.
I don't remember that character's name, and I don't know what his title is, but he is the bureaucratic adversary.
He's got a suit and a tie.
And we have the guy in the military suit who shows up occasionally at meetings too.
Right.
It's hard, you know, I mean, in the book, she goes to a lot of meetings, and I think those are fun and interesting. They're probably hard to adapt to TV in a way that would be fun and interesting.
Totally. You know?
you're tuning in for space meetings.
he's in the book, and I would say that the Secretary General is about just as visible in the book as he is here. But I would say the dynamics between these two are more clearly defined in the books, especially since they seem to have a clearer, friendlier rapport in the book initially, I would say. And I think that they seem to be a little more chilly toward one another in the TV series.
I think that's accurate. Okay, let's go back to the Rocinante. The Rocinante.
Back to space.
Oh, yes, back in space. We're in space now. That was easy. If only it were so easy. They rename the ship the Rocinante. They go to see Fred Johnson at Tycho Station. And basically it's this thing where there's this weird give and take about, like, there's the whole scene where they kind of come out and try to pretend that there's a whole bunch of Marines behind the door and he sees right through that, which I kind of like because it's sort of saying that, you know, these people are kind of out of their depth. But if people have thoughts about that, I'd love to hear it. And then also then there's that really weird turnaround where in the next episode, basically Fred Johnson says, "Oh, I've got this job I need somebody to do, but not you." And Holden's like, "No, it's us. We want to go out and have an adventure." That maybe it's like that in the book too, but it struck me as being sort of like, "Oh crap, we've got these people sitting at this base. That's not interesting. We need to get them back out in space. How can we do that? Fred Johnson has a job for them." So that was a moment. Actually, I think maybe the one moment in this series where I went, I'm not sure I follow the rationale for this convenient job that comes up. And, you know, unless we're led to believe that Fred Johnson invents this job in order to get them, but it seems like he doesn't want them to do it.
It has the role-playing game mechanic. He is the quest giver, and they have to go on the next quest, right? It's very much that, right? And, like, sure, they are the only living witnesses to two great catastrophes that are, like, causing the solar system to, like, tilt towards war. But, yeah, go on a secret mission and maybe die.
Yeah.
They recorded
their testimony first, so it's good.
Yeah, which we find out afterward, which is what makes that moment so weird. I kind of just wanted – I wanted something more to precipitate it. I wanted an event like – I wanted to see Fred Johnson be like, you know – mm-hmm. I got something that you would be good for or something, but instead it's sort of like
the UN is headed here now, you gotta get going. And maybe you could take care of this for me,
right?
Or something.
Instead it's like, oh, I overheard that you have a job to do, we could do a job for you. And I'm like,
it's like, probably those guys should be locked up and kept safe somewhere. Right. But you don't want to watch four episodes of them like playing cards.
That's right.
They're on Tycho Station. Save game. They're on Tycho Station longer in the book, just hanging out and talking and shooting the stuff.
Yeah.
But they
you didn't mention whoring, which also happens in the book. But you know,
I have a really strong objection to the bar scene here. But I'll save that till we get to it. But the thing that makes this so weird is they hit the standoff so hard, and then they flip immediately. Like you're saying, so then it doesn't
flip and
quite
burn. That's how they do it.
Yes,
and it's hard in some ways. I found because I had not read the paragraph version of the Butcher of Anderson Station backstory. I had not read the novella version, so getting a whole episode about it like kind of made that even trickier, right? Because In some ways, it works better for me when there's more mystery around him, as opposed to like, yeah, we're going to try and bluff this evil guy, or not evil, but complicated guy, or we'll take a job for him. Either way, we don't know what we're doing. So,
I just question his tactical ability then. He's like, yeah, sure, these guys who couldn't bluff me out of like this little simple standoff situation, mm-hmm. I'm going to send them across the system to this dangerous thing that has caused all these problems.
Well, they've had so much bad luck, honestly, the Rocinante people, that you could argue, but I feel like I'm getting into headcanon here. Mm-hmm. You could argue that what I'm doing is saying, look, what if we record their statements and then get rid of them? Then they're out of here. And our space station probably won't blow up, because that's what happens wherever they go. Well, I'll send them on this mission. They'll be out of our hair. But I don't know if that's supported in that episode. It feels it is that quick turn of like, you know, now I've got a job for you to do. Joe, do you want to talk about the bar scene? This is as good as any. We're in space now, so
we're in space. We can talk about bars whenever we want.
Mm-hmm. No, space bars.
The bar kind of bugged me. It was, you know, one of those TV bars where the lighting is just right and everyone can hear each other talk to each other about their backstories and stuff.
At least they were sort of shouting to each other. I will give them that.
Yeah, but it was weird because it also had, they tried to introduce some of the Amos backstory here with his life. But they did it in a very strange way where they had the guy come over and like basically proposition him. Exactly proposition him. And he says, no, thanks, I'm not interested. And then he has the weird aside where he's like, be careful, you know, the knife and et cetera. And then the guy's like, thanks, man, and walks off. And I'm like, oh, God. It's a little forced. It didn't feel organic. And he turns and he talks to our other Rocinante friend, and they share their backstories back and forth a little bit here. And it's just like, it just feels forced, and I didn't like it.
I agree that it felt forced, but I think for me, it still worked to humanize Amos a little bit, because we really haven't had anything at all to do that. So at this point in the series, I'm sort of just grasping at any little crumb and nibbling it up as fast as I can. So even though I didn't feel like it was the most elegantly played scene, elegantly written, it still did what it was supposed to do for me, who has only read the first book and doesn't really remember it that well. So I'm sort of discovering his character as I watch it unfold on the screen. And I feel like after these four episodes, I'm definitely liking him more I did going into them.
I feel like 6, 7, and 8 all do some work to service Amos and get him to be more of an interesting character. You get a better idea. He's not just kind of a scary thug who will hit you with a wrench in space if you look at him funny. He's much more interesting, I think, after 6, 7, and 8. Not like super, super detailed at this point, but more interesting as a character with a little bit more detail.
Well, he definitely has more detail than he did in the book. In the book, he's just like exactly what he was at the beginning of the series, where he's just like big guy in space who hits things. And they try to weave in some of the other things, you know, when he talks about the churn, etc.
The churn, yeah.
Yeah, it was like
That's the name of a novella. You can I waited for the little ping, buy this on Amazon now for $1.99. The churn.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I will say to commend the bar sequence is I'm happy that they at least had some semblance of same-sex attraction, even though it was this weird thing here with the prostitute. Whatever.
Well, it was nice, though, that, you know, he turned him down, but he did not turn him down in a way that at all, you know, made you think that he was homophobic. It was just he was simply not interested. Watching television from this day and age, when you have a character like that who is just kind of the big guy in space who beats people up, you expect a hint of that sort of negativity coming from him. And it was kind of refreshing to see that that's not the world that we're living in. That is not the character that we've got on screen.
Yeah, I'm very relieved by that. So it was nice. I appreciate that. That and unfortunately, our dead diplomatic friend. Diversified some science fiction, so it's nice.
That's right. His husband will never forgive Epicerola. Will never. No wine for her. I figure though that his son or nephew or whoever will get out of prison now. Yay.
I hope so.
Yeah, your uncle's killed himself, but it's okay. You're out. They leave Tycho Station and they go to Eros. And we'll leave Eros, and we'll circle back to it when we get over to talk about Miller. But before we do that, I wanted to at least mention another character that does not appear in the books at all, which is Mr. Contact Lens Spy Guy, who is found lurking aboard the Rosinante on their way to
the way to Eros. I thought I had forgotten an entire character.
Nope.
I was like, wow, I remember
Kenzo,
this even
Kenzo
less
the
well.
Spy.
He's new, Mr. Spy Eye Guy.
I guess he's there so they have someone to talk to. Because otherwise there's a lot of just
so
being
lonely.
In space. And he fills in a lot. I mean, I feel like there's a lot in the books where Holden and crew don't know what's going on.
Right.
And so we have somebody to kind of be like, whoa, you know, I've read a newspaper recently. Let me tell you what's
up. Mr. Exposition dump.
And to let us all feel like there's danger. And, mm-hmm. like the audience and the characters to know that like there's danger and there's a lot going on and there's spycraft and there's mm-hmm. it's complicated, so it's not like just fly into an asteroid kind of
he's
kind of
a
stuff.
Very cooperative spy though.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
To a point. Yeah. He's very true. Cooperative
until he tries yeah. to get them all killed.
Yeah.
I liked him. I liked the addition of him because, like you said, the dramatic tension, because it would be kind of dull otherwise, but it's also nice because as someone who's read the book, you get something where you don't know where they're going to go with it exactly. It could have some major impact on the story, or it could just weave in back into where the story was, and you don't necessarily miss anything. So it's interesting to have something like that introduced in the TV series, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I quite enjoyed, I mean, I think Windmills is probably my favorite of the episodes just because so much stuff happened in it that I enjoyed. I really liked the scene where the Martian patrol, you know, comes along and they have to figure out how to get into the safe.
Oh.
And I felt like that was the second episode done right, because I didn't care what was happening, you know, with having to send a distress call through the broken transponder in episode 2. But here, maybe it's simply because I know the characters better, and because you also had that added wrinkle of this one character, can you trust him, can you not trust him? And so I really liked that episode, and I was, that part of it had me almost literally on the edge of my seat waiting. And when it was over and they had succeeded, and you know, ubiquitous and polyglottal and all those fun words and stuff, I was left with this sigh of excited relief, like, yes, they nailed it. I felt good about it.
Well, and it's a countdown, right? It's a mm-hmm. James Bond diffuses the bomb countdown, except done in an interesting way where it's the countdown is that they're going to board them, and it is kind of fun, the, you know, how do we get into this safe so that we can get the code words out? Like, how can we force it? Can we force the computer to open it? Like, it gets complicated, and it does ratchet up the tension. And then there's also the question about are the code words still going to be good, and you know, was this something you misremembered about having a code word, you know, because that's they're asking Alex to, you know, they're relying on his knowledge of Martian secrecy and code words, but it totally works in the end.
Donkey balls.
You know, it's totally donkey balls. It is interesting too that, you know, you were talking about the spy character didn't exist in the books, and we never got those scenes at Holden's home. And I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page and realizing that that episode was actually written by Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank.
Yes.
And that's the only one that we have seen that's actually been by them all the way along so far. And it's the one where we're getting the most stuff that didn't already exist. So
mm-hmm.
it is kind of nice that you get the author's hands in there doing the heavy lifting when you're adding something and making it out of whole cloth.
Yeah, they're creating their own thing. This is their George R. R. Martin Game of Thrones episode, right? The writers get to write one episode a season. Before they get to Eros, they also find in episode 8, Salvage, they find basically the stealth ship that blew up the Canterbury. This is also the ship that we see at the beginning of the first episode, it turns out. Mm-hmm. Where we saw Julie Mao and the sort of screaming body parts of blue glowy things in the engine core. And so this is a moment where a key a key thing that is in the very first scene of the season, but it finally kind of like all connects together because they find this ship. This is the ship that blew up the Cant. It's an unknown stealth class vessel of some kind, and the shuttle is gone. And the short range shuttle is gone, and all the airlocks are open, and the reactors turned off, and they do that thing very much like in episode one, they do the claustrophobic going through the spaceship thing. And what they find when they turn the reactor on is that moment. I think it's a good moment, and that it's the what the heck is that? That it's like creepy. There's like alien goo in this show. It turns out.
You gotta like some good alien goo.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to a bunch of people about this episode, and I some people I talked to really kind of struggled with, like, what are we supposed to be seeing in that episode, right? And I guess I was sympathetic to that it is kind of unclear, right? And it's a little ambiguous, and you kind of want someone to say something more about, like, what this is. They avoid showing a lot of it for special effects purposes. We get this weirdness, but it's unclear. Like, I think to some viewers, like, well, yep. how weird is this supposed to be to these characters, especially in the science fiction world? Mm-hmm.
Since it's a ship, yes. A ship that's new stealth technology that these characters wouldn't necessarily know what it's supposed to look like in the first place. So we as the audience definitely aren't going to know what it's supposed to look like. And I did notice a couple of lines that I thought they threw in there to try to make it clearer to the audience. Mm-hmm. Because you have Naomi saying something like, you know, it could be some weird kind of nano coolant that froze, you know, when they vented the ship. Mm-hmm. But I felt like that was still just too subtle because it just still was not clear enough that this is supposed to be that wacky and weird, because Steven had the same thing when I was watching it with him. I sort of had to explain, that's not supposed to be there. That's not what it's supposed to look like.
Yeah. And I feel
thought
like
it
there
was clearer in episode one or in episode eight. In episode one, which is supposed to be this really weird moment with the kind of human shaped body parts and glowy blue and all of that, I thought, and even knowing what it was supposed to look like, I'm like, I don't really even know what I'm seeing here.
Yeah.
And in episode eight, I felt like it was a little bit clearer that this was weird stuff that they're getting close to, and it starts to sort of reach out for them, and they're like, whoa, that is not supposed to happen. But I can totally see the point that I was still struggling a little bit with it. Wish it had been, I mean, maybe it would have looked worse if it had been like bigger and more kind of in your face, but it was kind of hard to scan what it was.
And I have to say, so I was watching it with someone who has not read the books, and they were confused about the sequence of events, and like we paused, and like I guess I had some confusion because they had thought that, you know, they had remembered that Julie Mao was in the very first scene that we saw, but had kind of inferred or assumed that was on the Scopuli, which it's not, right? It's on the Anubis.
It's the same, the airlock thing with the like blood smudge and all that. That is the same place. Yeah.
And there is some stuff that is confusing, right? Like right now, or that is not answered yet intentionally, right? Like right now, the viewer of the show does not really know where the crew of the Anubis is or where the crew of the Scopuli is, right? We have basically two empty ships. But it is a little confusing in terms of, like, what's the order of events in terms of when the Anubis blew up the Cant, when Julie Mao escapes, and what happens there, right? That I am a little confused about that. Mm-hmm. So, like, because we see the scene with Julie Mao and things are bad on the Anubis. So presumably we saw that scene, but then that ship, I mean, is that the exact same ship that blows up the Cant, or it's of the same class of ships that blow up the Cant? Because there's a couple stealth ships, right? Because they go after the Martian fleet. So
I think they think it's the same, but it's
does that make sense though in terms of
I'm not
timeline?
Sure. I'm not sure if it does make sense.
It's
certainly of the same kind, right? It's certainly the same kind of ship that blew up the Cant.
It doesn't make sense assuming we see the episode. Assuming the scenes are not shown out of order, it doesn't totally work, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. If we assume that very, very first scene of the first episode is, you know, sort of like we're seeing that and then suddenly flashback to all the stuff that happened before it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Otherwise, it doesn't work. That's true.
Yeah. And then I think this episode I liked it. I liked a lot about Salvage, but there is some stuff that's hard to follow. I mean, there are code names. There's a spy. There's two ships with, you know, names that there's a lot of people leaving jumpsuits with the name of the ship around, which I guess that's how you solve a murder in space. It's that everybody leaves a jumpsuit behind that's embroidered with, like, this is where I was. So.
Well, there's no DNA testing and footprints.
Just jumpsuits.
Yeah, I was actually glad to have the added spy character most of the way through Salvage. I felt like he made things clear. And we're not talking about Eros yet, but there's a scene on Eros where I was so glad that he was there. Yeah.
No. Well, Kenzo the Spy is a quality NPC that I feel like was a good addition to the campaign. So.
Well, the only thing about Kenzo is that I thought for sure they were going to kill him here to demonstrate the danger of the goo. Because it was like, well, they're not going to keep him around forever. Like,
I did think he was slated for whatever fate that, you know, like the medic, you know, it's like, I'm not going to get attached to this guy. Like, you know, spy who was stowed aboard on their ship. Like, you know, at some point something dangerous is going to happen and no one's going to risk their life for Kenzo. Sorry, Kenzo.
Yeah. Well, so I thought that would have been an opportunity to show sort of the danger of it. But, you know, they didn't do that in the book. They just had weird stuff that was there and then they left. But to go back to something Jason had said about the first episode where the threat of what it was that Julie saw wasn't immediately clear, like that was way clearer in the prologue to the book.
Yes.
Because there's something that talks to her. So that threat level I think is just missing there, and maybe that would have helped us here to identify that this was, you know, super horribly bad for them and that it was going to do something to them if they touched it, but we don't really totally get that. Like they just seem like creeped out by it, and it moves, but it's not like it's like thrashing around and reaching towards them in like a really super threatening way. It's just sort of like a space bouldery thing.
It's space moss right now.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, it's. I'm going to draw another parallel to Game of Thrones here, which is I think fair. Daniel Abraham has worked quite a long time with George R. R. Martin, and I sometimes feel like this is the Expanse book series and TV series is lessons learned by somebody observing what George R. R. Martin went through with the adaptation of Game of Thrones. This moment in the first episode is the Expanse version of the first scene of Game of Thrones, which is, hey, there's these creepy pale zombie creatures who are, what, you know, what are they all about? They're like, this is a world with zombies and they seem scary. And then in Game of Thrones, they do the trick where you see that and then you just don't see them again for a long time. But when they come back, you're like, oh my God, I forgot I was watching a show with magic zombies in it.
Yeah.
And so I think the purpose of that first episode's first scene is to have us be, it should be more clear. Unless if they're playing coy, I feel like it doesn't work because it works better the way Game of Thrones does it, where you should be like clearly seeing kind of like body parts in the goo and faces and hear a voice and have
it. I mean, I was avoid saying anything like that just for kind of spoilers, but yeah, I mean, it's
but
the,
well, I
the
mean,
nature of it's
there are
unclear.
Like sort of silhouette shapes in the goo in the first episode, but it's not that clear. And I feel like it would be much more effective when you get to episode 8 to have that moment like you did in Game of Thrones where you're like, oh geez, I forgot I was watching a show where there's alien goo. Because I thought this was just a show with, you know, that it was just sort of like people in spaceships in the future. And now there's this whole fantastical element that I had really not, I lost track of that. But instead, it's sort of like, oh, it's that sort of vague, gooey thing that I don't even remember from that thing that I didn't understand at the beginning of the first episode, which
and
is
I,
not
I
as
I feel
effective.
Like it suffers, especially because we have, like, Holden and his crew and also Miller are just kind of getting buffeted about by these, like, political forces that they don't understand, that, like, there being some kind of science force they don't understand is just like another thing on the, like, we don't, you know, we're just being cast about by the winds of the solar system.
Solar winds.
Yeah. Solar winds.
Sure. Should we talk about Miller?
Well, I was going to talk about their drone that they got.
Oh, sure, Joe.
Not in the book. So they got a drone.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, are they selling toys now? Like, what was the purpose of the drone?
it was very toyetic.
It's looking
yes.
Well,
to
I
quote
mean,
Freakazoid.
If you've got that's what a, I'm here for. If you've got if you steer your ship with an iPad, why would you not also have a drone?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It all
it's
fits.
Like they're Sphero BB-8. Yeah. But for space.
Wouldn't that have been something if they just put a little ball on the floor and kind of roll the ball around?
Yeah, well, it does raise an interesting question. Like, when Naomi was walking around, and it's like, oh, you know I'm an engineer, and it shows her the engineering console thing, and she's all like, oh, that's interesting. And then, so there seems to be some intelligence that they're imparting to this computer, and it has these drones, but it doesn't seem to mind safecracking. So it's interesting, because that's none of that's in the book.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right, Miller. So Miller.
Speaking of being confusing.
So Miller.
I felt a little lost too.
Miller's on Ceres, and he has a long talk with what's his name?
Anderson.
The guy
Dawes.
With the weird accent. That's what I call him.
Yes, all those things. Jared Harris is what I was going for. Jared Harris, an actor I really like. He's doing a very weird accent. His Belter accent, and they try to sort of get him to not to just work for the OPA and not bother with this stuff anymore. And he gets kidnapped, and then he gets what?
He finds saved. Clues that lead him from one thing to another, sometimes very quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
He manages to hide the disc that the little chip that he found in the hamster or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
By cleverly distracting Jared Harris with dialogue so he doesn't find it in his hat.
In his hat, yes. Who would look in the hat? That's crazy. But he gets fired. And he says goodbye to the place that he's grown up all along. He breaks into Julie Mao's apartment again. We get to see the CGI bird and the CGI
it's worse this time,
hamster.
I think.
One more time, and then he boards a shuttle for Eros, because that's where he thinks mm-hmm. his lead is on where Julie Mao ended up with her ship.
Yep.
That's sort of his arc on Eros. Now,
Eros looks a lot like Ceres.
On Ceres, yeah.
Well, that does make sense.
I mean, yeah. It does make sense, but it also like... Come on, couldn't you guys at least paint this one red or something?
So
do a palette swap?
So what's confusing? Oh. What's confusing about Ceres?
Well, you know, Steven actually said, he said, every time we go back to this guy, I never know what's happening, what's going on. Like, and I was a little lost too. His conversations with Jared Harris didn't quite, I had trouble following them in trying to figure out what each side of that conversation was trying to do. The only thing I knew was that Miller was trying to hide the information from him, but I had no idea what the OPA wanted from him or what they were trying to do. And I wasn't sure why he was back at Julie Mao's apartment again at the end until, you know, I figured out he found some money and stuff. But is that what he was there looking for? It wasn't particularly clear. And then when he spends all that time staring at the bird, I was like, okay, what is this supposed to mean? I was a little frustrated.
I think
by
he's
that
saying
point.
Goodbye to his life at that point because he's lost.
Yes, but it didn't seem. I think the problem is he's this character who's supposed to be so taciturn and gruff that I never knew when I was supposed to be thinking that he was feeling an emotion because he doesn't emote.
No.
So mm-hmm. I wasn't sure when it was supposed to be that or when he's just supposed to be thinking. It's too hard.
I have to say his performance isn't really helping. They're trying to out clever one another when he's talking to Anderson Dawes, and it, as the audience, we don't know what they're being clever about. So mm-hmm. it's kind of lost on us. Other than we know that there's obfuscation, we don't know the full depths of it. I would say, especially when we start getting into brother and sister, and it's like, are they his kids or what? And like, oh, they got killed, but then no one seems to care, and then there's the partner who cares and is all like, oh gosh darn it, Miller, and he's all like, I'm not gonna kiss you because I'm in love with Julie Mao or something. It's just like, this is so weird. I don't understand. It just feels like a lost opportunity.
I do feel that the one thing that kind of was winning me over a little bit about this part of it was just the whole Miller falling for Julie Mao thing reminded me of one of my favorite movies, Laura from 1944, which was actually also one of David Lynch's, one of his things that helped him write Twin Peaks. So, like, it was reminding me of things I liked, but it's not great when the best part of something you're watching is that it reminds you of something you like better.
Something else. I think talking about Anderson Dawes, about Jared Harris, who, again, I really love as an actor. We talked about this in one of our previous episodes, the Belter language and all of that. I think it's great that they're doing that and having that out there. But Jared Harris's performance for me is a problem because it's in this uncanny valley. He is speaking not clear enough for me to understand him, but they don't subtitle him because he's not actually speaking something that's not English. It's understandable if you are lucky enough to be able to figure out what the heck he's saying. But his accent is so weird that I feel like they should have either made him clearer or made him less clear and put subtitles on him.
I think they should have done that. I mean, I feel like there are other movies where they do that, and that's fine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Because I feel like I was at sea with half of what Jared Harris was saying. Just like, I have no idea what this is. And I really like Jared Harris. I think he's interesting looking. He's interesting sounding. But I didn't know what he was saying most of the time.
I was actually picking up on a lot more of the words than I expected. You know, just with the smattering little bit of Spanish I know, and a few words in French here and there. So I was getting a lot of the specific meaning of the words and the sentences, and I thought that was interesting. And you know, I like his accent. It's weird, but I do agree that it would have been really fun to have him speaking even more in the patois, even stronger accent, and then subtitle it in a way that, you know, is subtitling the meaning as opposed to like the direct translation of the words he's saying, because then you get the fun of, if you're the kind of person who buys the box set and goes back and watches and rewatches, then you get to compare the differences between the words that he's actually saying. You'd be like, oh, that's the Spanish word for whatever it is.
Yeah.
And yeah, totally missed opportunity.
Yeah, one of the scenes I was a little disappointed by was the scene about his backstory of when Miller and him are having that thing about his sister who had died and the circumstances of that. He's very specific in the technical details of how they went on the spacewalk and how she was having these problems and stuff. And it's really hard to follow along, like you're saying, that when there's this sort of like quasi heavy level of sort of nonsense over it, and also the sound mixing I don't think helped. Everybody was kind of mumbling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's been a problem at several points in this series. That it's hard, like the first episode is there are moments where I felt like it was just not clear. The audio mix wasn't clear, and I get the, again, there may be some attempts to have that be for stylistic reasons, but in the end, if your understanding of the episode is harmed, then you've gone too far. And it's not even a matter of not paying attention. I was closely paying attention and had a hard time understanding what he was saying. And I feel like that crosses the line to be now it's actually more difficult. You're not making your show better when you do that. I think you're right about Miller. Miller, he's so taciturn. You know, they're doing the noir detective thing, and I get it, and I get that he gets in trouble with the mob, essentially, and mm-hmm. he just wants this one thing, and they want him to go join them or go away, basically, mm-hmm. and they're not interested in his quest, his mm-hmm. Quixote-like quest, dare I say. They just are not interested in it. And so I get that. I get that Jared Harris is kind of the tough mob enforcer guy. But when you've got that kind of story and you've got Miller being just so kind of disconnected and messed up, it's very hard to get a grip on like what you're actually seeing because it's difficult to access it. I agree. I thought this was some of the most difficult to process stuff in the whole series, especially the stuff with Jared Harris. That was like right at the core of, because once he's sort of going, he's got his little hidden thing in the hat and he's been fired and he's going to get out of town. I feel like his story kind of picks up. But you know, but it's a long time, several episodes to get to that point.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Basically everything on Ceres, terrible. Ceres, worst place in the solar system.
Ceres, you know, they almost had to. They had to spend some time because we need to get to know Miller. But it does sort of feel like they did not have seven episodes of Ceres material.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also feels like they had interestingly, it feels like they had too many different ideas too, because they had the unrequited love interest, they had the partner who falls in love with a belter, and they have a relationship and he gets stabbed and stuff, and they have like all
slightly
of that stuff
impaled, slightly impaled,
it's just a flesh wound,
and they have the whole thing with the birds and the animals and the oxygenators, and it's just like there's so much stuff on Ceres that they could have dealt with any one of these. I think it's just that they just sort of like stuck a finger in each one of these and just sort of twirled it around and then back out again, and we don't know what to feel about any of it.
My theory is that they knew that they didn't have enough story for Miller, and so they decided to use Ceres as their world building. You know, let's give you a little sense of what the future is like for people living in these asteroids, which I think is not a bad thought, but it does not feel as organic as perhaps it some other approach could have done. There's a lot going on, and I would have, I think, been more satisfied if this had been a little bit more straightforward detective story where the aspects of the culture kind of come into view as Miller is following a series of leads. But Miller doesn't have that many leads, and it's stretched out over a long period of time. And I feel like that's part of the problem, too, is Miller's investigative momentum never feels like quite enough. Like everything seems to be moving so slowly with him. I never feel like in the book, I kind of felt more like, because we had access to his inner thoughts, like I was reading a detective story and he was going through this whole chain of events. And meanwhile, is becoming increasingly obsessed with Julie Mao and imagining her. And we don't see his imagination of her either, right? So we don't have a detective story, and we don't have the interior world of him kind of losing it. Instead, we've just kind of got this slow moving thing. And it like you said, Joe, I think it's a missed opportunity, because it would have been kind of fun to have a little more space detective happening at a faster pace. And there isn't so much of that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that Thomas Jane's performance really helps out here, because he kind of has this sort of like laid back kind of tone to everything he says, like he's trying to do like a Humphrey Bogart impersonation, and I don't think that's helping, because I think there should be some more urgency or at least concern or frustration about the events that are unfolding, but he doesn't seem to have that. He doesn't seem to have the urgency that you would expect if he was actually this obsessed with finding something.
He should be becoming more unhinged as things go along. And I also feel like when he gets sidetracked by Jared Harris, I kind of want him to lose it. Like, you're getting in my way.
And we get some of that never does. In Salvage, which I like. But I think feel
it's
like,
his best performance in Salvage.
Yeah, I think he's great in Salvage. And we get a lot of that. But there was no kind of ramp up to it, right? That makes it tricky, right?
He's just the laconic Miller in episodes 1-7, and then in episode 8 he kind of snaps to attention once he gets out of Ceres and is on his way to Eros, and then he's got something to do. He's active, and suddenly I like him a whole lot better, and I think Thomas Jane's performance in episode 8 is pretty great.
Yeah, so obviously Ceres is just sucking all of the energy out of him and the show and everything.
Oh, well.
Yeah, suddenly he gets to Eros and, hey, he's kind of a cool character. Now I'm interested in watching this guy and watching him play off of the other ones, which is the most exciting thing.
It's the hat. The hat obviously had to go.
I did. Was dragging
I have to
him
say,
down.
That is, so we're into episode 8 when these two storylines come together on Eros. I laughed out loud at the scene where he meets his contact, his buddy, and he's like, "You didn't bring my hat?" And it's like that level of like, oh my God, it was somebody else's hat, and he was
the
going to
time.
See that guy, and he didn't bring it. Oh! That was the funniest line in the show. That was so good. And it's so Miller, too, because it's like, what a jerk. You borrow the guy's hat, you wear it the whole time, and you leave it behind when you're going to see him.
Which we then find out that there was also sort of a deeper character-based reason for that, because he gave him the hat to help him keep his head and, you know, stay in the game. And when he's finally going to leave Ceres to just go off on this crazy vision quest, he leaves the hat behind because he recognizes that he has lost his head at that point.
And he's leaving all of his life behind by doing it. He's never left series before. So that is a big moment for Miller that we kind of get retroactively in episode 8 rather than having it be quite as dramatic, I think, in episode 7. I like the conversation in episode 8, by the way, with the at the very beginning with the Mormon missionary.
Yeah.
I thought mm-hmm. that was a cool scene that takes that character seriously. He's not a joke character, and still allows Miller to be cynical and not believe what he's selling.
And fills in the world. That one little scene managed to do a lot, right? That other scenes I think tried and were much less successful at doing. So
yeah, that was really good. I think that was probably one of the better scenes out of the series. And unfortunately, we're 80% of the way through the show when that happens.
I think so. Erica says she liked episode 7. I think episode 8 is the best of the 8 that we've seen so far. I thought it was
the most exciting.
I thought it was
close.
Fantastic. It's close. Yeah. I mean, because Miller is active in it. I think that's what pushed it over the edge for me, is that we get some claustrophobia on the spaceship. Miller is active, and then we get the big kind of coming together mm-hmm. moment in the last couple of acts.
And I loved how they shot the scene in the flop house with everyone kind of waiting around.
Wrong flop house. The hotel. The crappy hotel.
And like Amos is just itching and he's unzipping his jumpsuit so he can get his gun out ready. And it's just that was so perfect.
Silent, right? Yes. There's no music. There's just no really aggressive sound effects. They're sort of like they're diddling around with a couple of computer interfaces, mm-hmm. and there's like the air recirculation hum, and that's it. And it's just like super tense.
And it was such a nice kind of flip.
That I was really glad that we had the spy there, mm-hmm. because
yes.
I was in reading the book. I was a little bit confused as to what was happening during this scene. Like I couldn't quite follow what was going on. Whereas here we have the spy with his heads up display, so you can actually see things that he is seeing, and you can see that like a attack team has been deployed. Somebody is coming to get them. So you recognize. I mean, yes, from the direction you're going to recognize something is about to go down. But I was understanding why something was about to go down,
right.
and who had planned it, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that was a masterful scene. It was really good.
Yeah. My boyfriend was unfortunately not as observant about the tack team part, and so he was like, why is everyone just standing around inside a thing? It was like, something might happen.
Yeah.
And it was because I had assumed that he had seen the previous thing, but he hadn't. Until after the scene had
literally text on the screen.
Yeah, I know.
I liked the idea that, you know, like Amos especially, he knows what's going on. Like his radar goes immediately that this is a problem. Like something is wrong here. We don't trust this. Something is going on. Is it the guy behind the desk? Is it the people at the desk? Is it those people over there who are buying something at a vending machine, a space vending machine? We don't, you know, but something is up, and then it all kind of falls apart. And then we get a, you know, good old fashioned gunfight.
Which I do have one problem with, and it's not my usual problem. Usually I am bored by gunfights, but this was actually pretty interesting. My problem was, what is that couch made of?
It's
that
armor
are not
couch.
Going through it. I am like, space couches are much tougher, I guess.
I mean, I think if you're decorating the lobby of a space flop house, you know, you want things that are going to take a bullet.
It's like dorm furniture, you know. you don't make it for comfort; you make it to last.
Yeah,
Kevlar cushions,
or again, headcanon. Headcanon, I'm ready here. The guns that you're firing inside a space station, maybe they don't have great penetration power because that would be super dangerous.
In
there
space.
There.
Space bullets.
Space headcanon.
Good job, Tony.
All right, I am on board. You've
I'm
sold
here to
me.
Help.
Okay.
Or, so it's just a really great couch.
So things are looking pretty bad for our heroes in this gunfight. And but then some dude who isn't wearing a hat comes in to save the day.
Yep.
And that's a nice, there's that moment that even knowing that it's coming, because I read the book, there's that moment of like, everybody's in the same scene together. Yep. Hooray!
I was giddy like a schoolgirl, just like waiting for this scene to come up. And then it was over and Steven was just like, oh, I love it when all the characters get together. And I was like, yes, that's exactly what you're supposed to feel like.
And then he's got his line and he gets in the elevator and that like Amos just kind of shrugs. That was so great. I love that.
Yeah. Well, you get the sense that between Miller and Amos that there's this understanding of like, oh yeah, okay, I get who this guy is. Joe?
Never mind.
All right. They go upstairs because in the end, they've both been looking for Lionel Polansky, which Fred Johnson has sent the Rosinante people to find because he's the only survivor of the Scopuli. And Miller has learned that Polansky is actually just an alias and it's where Julie Mao is staying. And they go upstairs to the room. A guy sticks his head out of the door to see what's going on in the hallway and is threatened. Go back inside, sir. Go back into your space flop house. And they open the door and find in a really bad smell. Thankfully, this is not smell-o-vision. It smells really bad. And in the bathroom, they find the body of Julie Mao covered in glowy blue starfishy things that we've seen before, glowy blue things, and that's really bad. And that, I believe, is where episode 8 comes to an end.
It's really bad, but it's not bad enough. This was, I think, the most disappointing of all of the scenes that I've seen so far, because, and maybe I just am remembering it wrong, but my memory of that scene in the book was that it was much, much grosser. Much more difficult to determine that had once been a human being, and that it was just, you know, gross and scary and disturbing on a level that is actually disturbing, as opposed to, oh, it's a lady with some stuff on her. Mm. It was weird looking, but I didn't find it as off the chart as I was hoping it would be.
I think they erred on the side of having you recognize that it was Julie Mao.
Mm-hmm. Except I'm not sure I would necessarily say, like, oh, It was like a super close up on her face or anything, because it was just like sort of like the flashlight goes over her real quick, and then we're just concentrating on a close up of Miller the whole entire time. I would have preferred, I think, at least like eye contact with the dead Julie Mao there, because it's just sort of like they just pass over her real quick and then they're out of the room.
I kind of wanted one of those like almost horror movie shots where, and because this is how I directed it myself when I was reading the book, which is, you know, she's like dead in a bathtub or something, you know, dead on the shower floor, and you sort of pass over her and the music is super creepy and it starts out as like you can see it's her face and that it's Julie Mao, and then as you keep panning down you realize that she's covered in weird goo and it's really gross, and then you cut away. And instead, it's just that one shot, kind of from a distance. Mm-hmm. She's glowy. The end. And I enjoyed this episode, but again, the it's like they don't want us to get too close to the goo, because all three of the appearances of the goo so far have been kind of at a distance and hard to understand. And I don't know what the rationale is for that, or if it's just that they had a hard time figuring out how to visualize it.
Well, I was hoping they would communicate more that it was threatening here. I think the trailer for the next episode actually communicates more about how threatening this is. So that's a little surprising. And we had seen some of this trailer material earlier on in the series run. I don't know how much
trailer.
At the end of the episode, they had a trailer.
Maybe they didn't have that in the US. On space.ca. Yeah. Or if they did, I missed it.
But it's very spoilery if you were
I think they wanted the emotional. I think the goal with this scene, again, I feel like I can understand what they're doing here. The goal here is to resolve the two things that have been happening in the show up to now, which is, one, what's the deal with the blue goo? And it's like, here it is. And two, oh, and it's on Julie Mao. We've resolved Miller's story, what he's looking for. And look, these two things have come together. She's dead and covered in the blue goo. And then what happens next? And I think, in episode 9, what happens next is, oh God, this is really dangerous. We may all die. We need to get out of here. But in episode 8, they just kind of want to have that moment of, it's her. She's glowy. Ah. But it's harder. This show, I mean, again, I don't know if it's me, but talking to all of you, I feel like it's not just me, and saying there are moments in the show where I feel like they are struggling to communicate.
Yes.
Some of the things that we know they're trying to communicate because we read the books, but that when you just look at what's on screen, they're having a hard time getting some of what they're trying to do across. Whether it's the people like Jared Harris and how they talk and what's going on in Miller's head, or it's things like the blue goo and how it's portrayed. Like, they're trying to be maybe a little too subtle and not and it's not landing.
Yeah, that's my concern as well. And I know that from conversations I've had with someone who has not seen it, or who has not seen, who has not read the books, that is also some confusion that they're having, and they're asking me questions. So yeah. I don't feel like this is doing a good job as a television show of communicating what it is that's right. happening.
Yep. Yeah, it's strange because there are things about the show. I've really enjoyed watching the show, and I thought that the last couple of episodes were especially good. I look forward to watching it every week, and yet I am frustrated. And this is the common theme is I feel like, you know, I'm okay with TV that says you need to pay attention and we're going to be a little difficult. You know, I like The Wire, right? But this doesn't feel quite like it's rewarding you for paying attention. It feels like they tried to have a light touch and it's so light that it's not there, and that they needed to be clearer, and they were not capable of making some of this stuff clear enough.
There are some really weird choices. We didn't mention it when we talked about episode 6, but episode 6, Rock Bottom, had the introduction of those two minor characters, where we had like the uncle and nephew. And like,
oh, yeah.
I found that really weird and disorienting because at first I was like, because those characters are not connected to any of the other characters. And I was like, did I miss the, like, what's the connect? Like, basically, I spent the whole first scene that they were on, you know, on the screen, like trying to figure out, like, am I supposed to know who these people are? Yeah. How are they connected to other characters that I know? And then I basically kind of missed their introduction, and then their other scenes didn't really, like, I only kind of vaguely followed what they were doing. And that felt like that felt weird because it's not like we had other scenes previously, like with little, like, you know, we're gonna have a couple scenes with other people on the belt to as world building. It's like, no, we're gonna try world building now in episode 6, and it's like, that's weird.
Yes, that's exactly it, because there wasn't anything else. And not only that, but they did a really good job of building out these characters. Like, I feel like I know those two characters pretty gosh darn well at this point, and that's not the kind of thing I expect from two throwaway characters who are just there to build the world and then, you know, blow something up. So my thought at the end of that scene was, oh, okay, so somebody's going to find this kid and he's going to become a major player somewhere later on. And
no,
he's just floating out in space.
It's well, I mean, the reason that story is there is to tell you that when Mars boards your spaceship, bad things happen. That's basically why that story is there, is to be a counterpoint to what's going to happen if Mars boards the Rosinante.
Actually, I think it would be worse in my mind imagining what would happen if they boarded the Rosinante, because it's an actual, like, Martian military vessel. So I would feel like, oh, they're in the right to actually be concerned about this. With this, it's like this is the petty abuses of the belt.
Yeah, they're the highway patrolmen of the belt.
Yeah,
right.
So I felt like that was trying to build out something different than the threat to them, so much as it was the reasons why the Belters
are angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also the reasons why Mars was jumping up their patrols, because this guy had blown up one of Mars's ships, so that, you know, gives a reason for the patrol to be out there in the first place.
All right. But it is a weird... I mean, it's very clear now. Without spoiling anything, it's very clear now where they are headed with the last two episodes. We speculated in the first one of our Expanse episodes about where they were going to break the season. Were they going to get the whole first book in, or were they going to break it at some point in the book? And I think at that time I said, well, I would probably break it at a certain point on Eros, and looks like that's exactly what they're going to do. But when I look at these 10 episodes and how they're paced, I think, you know, this is why you insert Butcher of Anderson Station. This is why you tell some of these side stories. This is sort of why Miller's story is given like a lot of time that is not necessary. It's because they have 10 hours and they want to get to a certain point in their plot in hour 10. And it doesn't feel, unlike something like Game of Thrones, where having read the books, I can see all the stuff that they're throwing overboard. Here, I feel like they're taking on more stuff in order to fill up, you know, fill up the boat before they can get all the way out to episode 10. Now,
go ahead.
Oh, well, next year they got renewed for 13 episodes. And I thought to myself, good. I actually think they've got a lot of story in this book series, and that with 13 episodes, they may be able to have it be strangely enough, better paced rather than, because I think they've got so much story, because I suspect that next season they're going to take bits from the first and second books and put them together, that that having a few more hours to tell their stories might actually serve them better, because this is a weird, you know, 10 hours to tell this chunk of story that they wanted to tell.
It's not even 10 hours, right? Because they're not hour episodes. Like, yeah. If it was,
well,
HBO.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so, 10,
it's
10,
even,
40,
it's even shorter than that.
42 minute episodes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it feels like when they're filling it up, like you're saying, they're filling it up with like knickknacks and not like with substantial material. Yeah.
And, you know, I was frustrated in the first half of the season with the episode where it's like, we're fixing the antenna. And it's like, really? That's the episode?
I know. There's,
I mean,
yep. Yeah.
It's like, honestly, it's all empty calories. They're filling up in like Cheetos and chips and stuff.
Guys, there's space. There's so much to do. Give me my space meal.
That's why seven and eight feel like this is what the show should always be. This is the pace that the show needs to
like,
be on.
It feels like it's all over the place, right? Like I really love 7 and 8 and I like 4 and 1's pretty good, but like there's some numbers I didn't list there.
Yeah. That's right. What? Yeah. There's some other numbers between 1 and 8.
Yeah.
I knew like 1. But I mean 1 was fine. But it didn't knock me over. I think the series really didn't start firing until it hit 4.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I think that it slowed down a little with 5 and 6, although it was, you know, it wasn't bad. It was just a little slower. And then with 7 and 8 it picks back up again. And I wonder how much of that is the stuff they chose to fill these other episodes with was not action. And I can't help but notice that many of the parts that we actually seem to like are the parts where they have some action happening.
Yeah.
And so maybe, hopefully, next season, they decide to fill up with some more action instead of, like, random stuff about things that we'll never hear about ever again.
I would say action or tension.
Yeah.
Yes. I was hoping that tension would go along with the action, but you're absolutely correct. They could just be shooting at each other and we wouldn't care, and then that would be terrible.
Right. Yes. Well, and I mean, also, like, there were some scenes that I liked that didn't really have action, like the scenes on the wind farm, but I felt like there was a good deal of tension there. There was still an interplay going on. There's push and pull happening in a way that I didn't find was happening in a lot of the other sort of fillery type scenes.
Yeah.
I guess it's the thing that's not really landing for me. It's, you know, in the books we have these point of view perspectives where we have a lot about what's going on inside people's heads, and I get and one way that you would adapt that to TV would be very talky. You have people doing a lot of talking about what's going on in their head,
or narration,
or like, you know, every other episode with Miller, he's doing his like, you know, detective's log, space detective's log. Here's what I've done, right?
Or Julie Mao like floating over his shoulder and talking to him.
Yeah.
You know, it's clearly imaginary, but you know, silly
and
as it is, it would.
I kind of want that, especially for like. I feel like I would like that for Miller, right? Especially, I think his stuff is particularly the weakest because he doesn't have a crew to talk to. He has his partner and his boss and other people, but like, there's so much of him just kind of, we don't know what he's doing or what he's thinking, that just kind of suffers. So I don't know, and I
also kind of wonder. There's some stuff that didn't quite land when they tried to say exactly what it was. Like when they tried to just do away with subtext completely. Like when Eversol is talking to the mother, and the mother says, "Oh, you're dancing around saying whether or not my son is alive, because you know he really is alive." And I was like, okay, well, that would have been subtext if you hadn't actually said that line. There's some things where it's like, I can understand their fear of going too heavy in that direction, but yeah, I mean, it's obviously not clear why, like we've all said, why Detective Miller is doing any of the things that he's doing. Sometimes he's just sort of like staring off into space, looking at CG birds. Mm. So it's just strange.
Well, we have 2 more hours, yes, less commercials, for this season. They're running back-to-back on February 2nd, so we will reconvene after that is all over and send off season 1 of The Expanse. But I think we've done a good job, if I do say so myself, of covering 4 episodes in a little more than an hour. Look at us.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, pat on the back,
very
guys.
Very efficient.
All right, go team. So I'd like to thank the team. Tony Sindelar, thank you.
It's my pleasure. I'm always happy to go to space.
Joe Steele, I will be sending you a robot hamster soon. It's in the mail.
That's a threat.
I look forward to taking out its memory card.
Excellent. And Erica Ensign, just remember to search the hat.
Always search the hat. Always. Words to live by.
Mm-hmm, I think so. And I am Jason Snell. Thank you to everyone out there for listening to TV's coverage of The Expanse. We have one more to go. We will see you next time. Goodbye.